I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which I create, speak and write today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging, acknowledging that the sovereignty of this land has never been ceded. Hello, this is Tonce, a podcast of in-depth interviews about emotions and the way they shape our lives. I'm your host, Claire Tonti, and I am so glad you're here. Each week, I speak to writers, activists, experts, thinkers, and deeply feeling humans about their stories. And this week, I have my sister. She's my little sister, but I've never really thought about her that way because she's such an incredible force and an intellect. Her name is Lucy Ann Tonti. And she is now an author. Her first book, Sundressed, has just been released and you can buy it in all good bookshops, just like a very good older sister. I'm shamelessly plugging it, but it's very easy to plug because it is a joy to read. Now, the book looks beyond sustainable fashion to a future remade by natural fibres. It's an exploratory deep dive into the art and industry of clothing and an ode to the possibilities in nature. Sundressed is an accessible, engaging and optimistic challenge to designers, farmers and business to think bigger. If we grasp their potential, natural fibres or fabrics will revolutionise more than the way we dress. Regenerative farming of fibres like cotton, wool, flax and cashmere can restore biodiversity, soils and water cycles, making it possible to create beautiful clothes while improving the environment. Luce introduces the farms and fashion houses that are changing the industry and uncovers a growing hive of activity worldwide, from mulberry groves in China and cotton collectives in California to Mongolian goat herds and Australian sheep farmers. Her extensive research in sustainability is interwoven with her insights and personal experiences in fashion houses internationally. With a designer's eye for detail and an insider's understanding of the market, Lucy Ann shows us where our clothes come from and why it matters. Aside from all of that, Luce talks to me today about our lives growing up in our house, about my extraordinary parents. She talks about why she's dedicated the book to our dad. And it's just a lovely deep dive into her love affair with clothing and what it means to her and womanhood as well and how it shapes who we are. She has some really big challenges for us, I think, to change the way we view our clothes and to create a world that is more beautiful and more sustainable through them, which I think is really inspiring. She also writes for the Saturday paper and is the fashion editor there. And she has a closet clinic in The Guardian, which is all about just this: how to care for our clothes, which I think is at the crux of what I struggle with. I feel like I don't wash my clothes well and I don't look after them well enough. And so I do end up buying more clothes because I haven't cared for them in the right way. So she's over there educating us in the practical matters of how to care for our clothes. And Sundressed is also just a beautiful look at those kind of inside stories of the fashion industry. And she tells us a few juicy tales in this episode. If you loved the film Devil Wears Prada, you might just find this episode really fascinating too. All right, here she is, my little sister, and I'm just so proud. Lucy Ann Tonti, author and journalist. I know. How are you feeling about everything, about the book launch and all the things?
Good. I think I'm just going to try and stay in a space where I'm not overthinking it and I'm enjoying it.
Yes. Because this is the bit where you should enjoy, right?
Yeah. And just remember that for tonight, anyhow, we're talking about my book and I know.
Because you wrote it.
Because I wrote it. I know it. So it should be fun.
It'll be great. Yeah. You can have a great time.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you can have a great time. And yeah, also you have a fabby dress.
I do have a beautiful dress, which helps a lot.
It does. I'm really excited about it.
Although my instinct, of course, now is to like wear something like boyish and so
and
look
black.
Like I don't care and not this like beautiful gown. But
that's a funny instinct because I have that too. Whenever I go, I don't know what it is. I always lean towards that and feel much more comfortable in that.
Yeah, because it means you feel like you're going to look cool and relaxed and like nonchalant, you know, as opposed to want everyone to pay you attention.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because you're comfortable in it, right?
Yeah, totally.
Which is super important when you're dealing
and
with
I
fashion.
Do have an amazing coat to go over my dress, which so I've got both, the best of both worlds.
You do.
Yeah.
And it's so chic what you're wearing. It just floats around you. Like there's even the draping, which is something I've always really noticed about you with clothes. It's not just the feel, is it? It's the light, the way the light plays on your clothing as well.
Yeah, it's a big one. And also the drape for me is huge. And that's why I never understand when people want everything to like fit them tight and like, you know, it looks, A, it looks so uncomfortable to me, and B, you want to see the way the fabric moves. That's the art of something well cut, is when it's not like to your body.
Yeah, not bodycon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that I think is the thing I find hard about fashion, with that is floaty and oversized. It's the balance of not making it look like you're wearing a muumuu as opposed to something.
I mean, I have described the dress I'm wearing tonight as a muumuu. But it, yeah, but look, if the fabric's beautiful and the draping is done well, then it shouldn't be like that. It's when it's cut very square and there's no kind of tucking or the fabric is particularly stiff that it makes it hard. Mm. But I also just think we always look the best when we feel good in our clothes. So if you feel like you're wearing a muumuu and it doesn't look good, then, you know, that's not something you should wear. You should wear something that makes you feel good.
Yeah, because that comes out then too.
Yeah. Yeah. You look, you know,
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
A friend of mine once said that if you wear, actually her mum said to me when I was a teenager, if you're wearing uncomfortable shoes, it'll show on your face.
Oh, that's interesting. I love that. That's really true. Yeah. Mm. There's this designer that I talk about in the book, Albert Elbaz, who was the creative director of Lanvin for a really long time, and he used to talk about dresses that would make a woman shine like she had just met someone new and exciting.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, he had lots of really great quotes.
Yeah. Any others?
The one in the book that I love the most is that he wasn't interested in designing a dress that made a man fall in love with a woman. He was interested in designing a dress that made a woman fall in love with herself.
Oh, stop.
It's so good, isn't it?
It's so good.
It's so good, yeah.
And isn't that the essence of getting older and understanding that actually what makes you a person that someone might be attracted to is actually that.
Yes.
You being in love with you and knowing yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So he was always like, it's not about a sexy dress that might show off the body. It's about a dress that makes a woman look intelligent and interesting. And that's like a completely different, you know, that's about the self-perception of the wearer.
Completely. And also the way a fabric feels, because that's also sensuality as well, right?
Yeah.
The way it falls and feels on your body ultimately then allows you to move in a way that you fall in love with. And then that draws people in. Not that that's the goal, but, you know, I do think that.
Well, it is kind of, you want to, like, exuding that kind of like being comfortable and charismatic and, you know, people respond to that. So it might seem superficial to be like, oh, no, I want to wear something that draws people in, but, you know, because that'll make me feel good. But actually you're drawing someone in because you're making them feel good too. And that's a really, you know, beautiful part of life. And I do think, I always think when people, when polyester comes up in these conversations, because inevitably it always does, you just never feel that good about yourself when you've got like a clammy armpit because what you're wearing is sticking to your skin, or you move and you get a whiff of your own body odor because polyester makes you sweat and it stinks, you know, like it's all of these things come into play when we're talking about feeling comfortable and desirable and intelligent.
And enjoying being in the world, I guess, because at the heart of it, in reading your book, it's about connection to our earth, really.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And also just that ability to go back to this time, which we had not that long ago, like pre-industrial revolution, the worship of the natural world was quite widespread. Like we think of it as something inherent to indigenous cultures, but animism and that way of thinking was actually all over the world. And then it was just that the Western countries industrialized and changed and moved away from those values because we learned how to exploit the earth's resources for profit. And then, you know, I don't need to give you a lecture on history.
No, but I love it. It's really interesting.
But I do think, like, when you start to pay attention to nature and when you think, actually look at a flower, like we just walked into the studio past Claire's daffodils that were growing in the garden, and, like, it's pretty amazing that this little seed in the ground gets the right combination of sunshine and rain and organisms from the soil, and then will sprout and grow. First this beautiful green stem and leaves, and then this amazing yellow, bright pop of yellow flower with its really delicate little petals. Like, and that's actually how that thinking, because we learn photosynthesis in primary school and the ingredients that go into making a flower, but it had kind of totally slipped from my mind as an adult. And when I started thinking about the origins of our clothes, when I was working with designers and talking about sustainability, it suddenly just dawned on me how actually amazing it is that we get to wear these things that are this combination of sunshine and nutrients and air, essentially, and water. And that was where the title came from, Sundressed.
It's so perfect.
So that's photosynthesis. And I should say that my very good friend Sian, it was her idea, her input, because I was really? Like, what about raincoat?
That's like very gloomy.
Yeah, and she was like, no, what about sundress? And I was like, yeah, that's perfect. And she was like, sundressed.
Yeah. And it absolutely is. And that comes so strongly throughout your book, this love of clothes and fabric, but the awe of nature, which when we start to deep dive into the way that we interact with our planet, at every turn, all of the solutions to our climate crisis actually feel incredibly good for us internally and restorative, yeah. Right?
In this way of thinking, yeah. I think then that's what drew me to it, because the other ways of thinking, they're like, oh, we'll just recycle all the polyester, and which is actually just plastic bottles that have been turned into polyester. This way of thinking where you're like drawn back to the natural world and to like kind of being in awe of its power, because every regenerative farmer that I spoke to was basically like, once I got the landscape working again, like once we'd restored, we'd stopped spraying synthetic fertilizers, which destroy the health of the soil. Once we got our water systems back in place, once we had, you know, layers of humus, making sure that there were microorganisms and things working in the soil, you can just get out of the way and nature will come back and take over for you. Because if you've got the right species of plants, you get the right insects, you get beneficial insects, and then you get predators who come and prey on them, like birds, and like all of those, all of that ecosystem functionality. Nature knows what to do. Nature's, you know, been doing it for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. So that kind of deference is so beautiful to me, instead of this kind of like dominate and destroy.
Yeah, and control. Because a lot of it is about control, isn't it? And thinking that we can tame everything, which is just so counterintuitive to the way nature actually can function.
Yeah, and instead of seeing us as human beings as like this integral part of an ecosystem where we're just one other animal with a role to play, this idea that there's a hierarchy that we can sit on the top of is really gross and pretty toxic. But I also always think it's important to, like, I'm not a farmer and I think it's important to, like, you know, show these people respect who've worked the land for generations and have been taught, you know, who are out there, you know, actually
at, like, the coalface.
Yeah, battling the elements. And so I think it's not helpful when we kind of, and I know it's not helpful because I've spoken to them, you know, to come in and be like, this is how it should be done and you've been doing it wrong. Because, I mean, who am I to tell them? But at the same time, these farmers, regenerative farmers that I speak to who are in those communities, feel everybody moving along and changing anyway, because of course they want to do the right things by their land, and they're all starting to, you know, see the kind of toxic cycles that they're stuck in, and they'll call it different things, like responsible stewardship as opposed to regenerative agriculture or beyond organic or like intelligent systems farming. Like there's many different names, and that's really exciting too.
Absolutely. I wanted to read this quote by a particular Australian farmer and author, Charles Massey, from your book. And he says, "It is clear we are now in a new dangerous era for life on Earth. Human activity has begun to overwhelm the great forces of nature, placing virtually all life, including humanity, at potential grave risk." Can you tell us his particular story of regenerative farming?
Yeah, I hope I get it right. He's a very special person, Charles Massey, and his book Call of the Reed Warbler was one of the first books on regenerative agriculture that I read, and I found it very inspiring. So he is a sheep farmer, and he inherited his property. His family had been set stocking for generations on the landscape, and it was really run down and quite barren, and the soil was very, very depleted. And he inherited the property when his father passed away quite young, so he was 21. And he'd studied biology at university, but when he inherited the property, he inherited his father's way of farming, which was spraying, set stocking, and kind of this cycle that farmers get into where they are in debt to chemical companies, in debt to machinery companies, because you need more and more nitrogen fertilizer because you're depleting the soil. So you kind of like, I've had other farmers describe it to me as kind of like being addicted to drugs.
Wow.
And so it got to a kind of a breaking point, and this is kind of what happens to most regenerative farmers when they need to make a change. I don't think there was a specific incident for him. Sometimes it's a wildfire. Sometimes it's just almost losing the property because you're in so much debt and your farm's not making money anymore. And he's on the Monaro Plains, which is particularly difficult landscape. It's very, very dry. And obviously he's Australian, so there's a huge amount of, you know, our climate's tricky. And there was long periods of drought up there. So, yeah, he was at a point where he almost lost the farm, and he realized that he needed to take a different approach. And so he went and did some courses, and kind of it all brought back his understanding of, you know, biology that he'd learned about at university. And so he started putting more holistic processes in place. And he has told me that it took about 10 years for his landscape to come back. So what you do, so you stop tilling, so you don't need like diesel to be running those big tractors. We can talk about holistic grazing in a minute, but you basically move the sheep around the farm in a different way so they're not depleting the grasses. You stop spraying synthetic fertilizers and nitrogen, and you reintroduce this idea of cover cropping and multi-species planting, which is more beneficial for the health of the soil. And over time, it doesn't happen immediately, but over time, the biological exchange between like the sunshine and the water and the plants in the grass start to basically rehabilitate the landscape. And I haven't been to his farm. I'm still waiting for my invitation. But
hello, Charles, if you're listening, Luz wants to go.
But I've been told by my friends who are there who have been there that it is just completely wild. Like, because you stop trying to tame nature and you brought back all of these different kinds of plants. So it's like this rolling, he's described it to me as rolling like orange grasses that were there when, you know, pre-settlement that have come back.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, so these grasses can have seed banks stored way underground, and when you give them the opportunity, the landscape will heal itself. So it took about 10 years for his to come back, but he says now he knows farmers where he was one of the first, so he was kind of trial and error, and you make a few mistakes and you've, you know, figure out what to do. But he thinks it can take just 3 to 4 years, which
is wild.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, that is completely wild.
Yeah. And the other benefit I should say as well is healthy soils, when you're restoring the health of the soil this way, they store more carbon. So these farms, when they start to operate like this and they're not spraying synthetic fertilizers that emit nitrous oxide, you're actually able to have a landscape that's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and reversing some of the damaging effects of the last 70 years of farming.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is a question I have. Is there anything about First Nations culture and people that you've discovered in this talk of regenerative farming?
So all of these principles, well, not all, you can't speak about Indigenous people like they're a monolith, but the regenerative agriculture principles, broadly speaking, draw on Indigenous principles of land management, and it's important to pay respect to that. And I thought a lot about this when I was writing the book, and the correct way to handle it was because, you know, sheep farmers are white settlers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all of the other fibres that we're farming this way are not farmed by Indigenous groups, except for some cotton farmers in China and India who are native to the land, and they're growing native seed cotton in those ways. And so I quote Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass in the book, which is an amazing, she's a Native American who is also a botanist, and she talks about the way that they view the land as kind of like their older brother or sister. And so it's not like that the land is teaching them, and it's not something that you can exploit. it's like something that you're there to take care of. And the Indigenous Australian principles are very similar. Obviously, there was, I think it was like 500 different clans and nation groups that were here when we came. So again, I don't want to say that they all had the same principles, but basically they were like the younger brothers of creation as well. And in my reading, my understanding is that it was, you had to leave the world the same as that you found it. And their ancestors were like represented in mountains and rivers and streams and trees. And so those principles are, you start reading about it and you just get completely lost in the how wondrous this other world is. But I also felt like it was important to tell the story that I knew that I could tell and leave space for those stories to be told by an Indigenous person. Yeah, yeah. Not a white lady, you know.
Yeah.
But also it's important to me to understand more about that as I go further down this journey. And like, I would love to stay open to the possibility of working with somebody, if not that I have a huge platform, but if I can ever be helpful with my platform to help someone else tell their stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a beautiful perspective to have, because there is an element in talking to First Nations communities, and I used to work in one too, of not just leaving it to them to educate us, but us seeking that education ourselves to be informed. So it's not always just their work. To be constantly, because that's an exhausting way of being in the world too, you know, from people that I've spoken to.
And, you know, I think it's important to say as well that also not all Indigenous cultures are great caretakers of the land. You know, like there are examples throughout history of, you know, Indigenous cultures that have caused extinctions in animals as well. So I think it's good to not also like be like, oh, the saviour's over here. And a lot of the principles in Regen Ag have been around in France for a very long time, you know, so it's also not all just like
from one particular group. There's it's worth looking at it as a whole planet, right? A whole, you know, thousands and thousands of generations of people caring for the land in different ways in the different corners of our earth, I guess.
Yes.
In so many ways.
Yeah.
I want to take you back now. Okay. I want to ask you your very first memory of clothing and fashion.
My first memory of kind of like a different understanding of clothes is probably not my very, very first memory of fashion. But when I was, I guess I was 19, and I got offered a job at Scanlan and Theodore, and I remember being a uni student and looking at the prices of these clothes. You know, it was like $400 for a jumper and, you know, $1,000 for a coat, and kind of walking through these racks and being amazed by how precious those fabrics felt, and how different was just such a different perspective of clothes. Because at that time, you know, we would buy, me and my friends would shop every Friday to buy a new cheap outfit that we would wear out to the club that night and then, you know, maybe never wear again. And this was a real kind of awakening for how beautiful, beautiful clothes could be. And that has always kind of stuck with me, because from that point on, my perspectives changed and the people that I was working for changed. And it always really, it hurts me even now anytime I walk into a big shopping mall and I see piles and piles of jeans and racks squished with so many t-shirts, and just like, you know, you look in these stores and like there's just literal piles of clothes falling over because they're stacked so high. And as soon as you have an awareness of how many resources go into those clothes, but also somewhere sitting behind a sewing machine is a woman, usually a woman, getting paid not very much to make these clothes that we don't care about at all, you know?
Yeah.
And that really, it's like it, when you start walking through shopping centres with that perspective in mind, you're like, my heart, get me out of here.
It's awful, isn't it? I find it so overwhelming.
Yeah.
And the trickiest part about it is the price point is, I think, a huge draw card for people, because not everyone has the resources to spend $400 on a top or a t-shirt, you know?
Yeah, it's true. And that's really tricky, a really tricky part of this conversation, because fast fashion kind of was introduced and changed around the late 90s, early 2000s. So it's not really that long ago, but it's still two decades, which is long enough for all of our patterns of consumption to have changed. But before then, clothes were viewed as something special that you took care of. And so while $400 might seem like too much to spend on a jumper, you know, but maybe instead of spending $150, you should be spending $300. And then instead of buying four jumpers in a year, you just buy one and you take good care of it. And because you bought only one beautiful one last year, you still love that and you're taking care of that. And like you build a wardrobe of high quality pieces rather than, you know, oh, it's not, I don't really love it, but I'll just get it because it'll solve this problem. And then oh, I don't really like it anymore. I'll just, you know, give it away to Vinny's or, you know, or whatever. And rethinking, because like, you know, we spend a lot of money on a car or we spend a lot of money on, you know, a table,
house. A house.
Yeah. We think about those purchases, like, is this going to serve me? Is this going to get me through the next 5 years, 10 years?
Yeah.
You know, is the quality there? Can I get it repaired? Like all these factors come into play with other things we buy. We've just removed those, that way of thinking when it comes to clothes because the price has been driven down so dramatically.
Yeah.
And so one of the stats that really scares me is since fast fashion came in around the early 2000s, our consumption has increased of clothing has increased by 60%.
That's insane.
It's a lot.
60%.
Yeah. But what's even scarier is that it's going to go up by another 60% by 2030. So we're not slowing down. And like that impact of, oh, now I can just, you know, now I can shop like a Kardashian, even if I'm shopping at Zara. Like I can go out and buy as many new things as I want because the price point is low. Like those levels of consumption, when we talk about people not being able to afford the $400 jumper, I kind of question it a little bit because our consumption isn't being driven by poor people. Our consumption is being driven by middle-class people who buy way too much crap.
Yeah.
And buy too much because it's cheap. And we've all started to see it because of, you know, you look at the rise of someone like Marie Kondo who's teaching people how to declutter their homes and everyone's like, oh, my God, I need that. But you don't have to declutter if you don't buy it in the first place.
I know. And do you know what, though? I do reflect on this because I think that there's an element of compassion we need to have for ourselves with this too. Mm. Would you agree? Because there's big systems set up to stop us and encourage us to keep buying.
Yeah.
And it's addictive. Like you were saying with the farmers using chemicals on the land,
yeah.
That's how we've grown up. Mm. And we haven't been taught a lot of these ways of mending and repairing. And if something is going to cost you $50 as opposed to $400, psychology suggests that's what you'll do.
Yeah. You know,
it's tricky.
It is tricky. I think there's something good that's worth keeping in mind too, right? Because fashion is so – the new thing promises that you might become a different person on the other side, you know? If I just had that dress, then, you know, I'll walk into the room and everyone will be like, who's that girl? But actually psychologically, so that's why that's the dopamine hit.
Yeah.
You want to buy anything.
I feel that so deeply. When I go to a new thing, I want a new thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there was one study that found the dopamine hit wears off as soon as you paid for it. So as soon as you walk out of the store, you're like, now I own this dress and I don't think it is going to change me because I already own it. So actually psychologically for the like, I don't shop like this. I find shopping quite stressful, but I know some people really get a thrill out of shopping. You would get the same dopamine hit if you just carried the item to the counter and then left it there and walked away.
Why during the pandemic I got into this terrible habit of putting a whole lot of things in my shopping cart at websites and never buying them.
Yeah.
But I just became really addicted to that. And I spoke to other people and they resonated because it's just the idea of putting it in the cart.
Yeah. That's, now I'm going to have it.
Yeah. But I never actually had to buy it. And when I have bought it, it arrives. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
I bought this thing now. Now I have to look after it and think about it and, you know.
Now I'm responsible for it.
Yeah, exactly. And that responsibility of stuff in our lives is something I think that we have both struggled with and resonated as kids too, coming from the generation of our parents who held on to everything.
Yeah.
You know, that wartime mentality mixed with how cheap everything becomes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really kind of big concoction of trying to declutter our lives constantly and being overwhelmed by things.
Yes.
Do you find that really overwhelming, having like clutter and lots of things around you all the time?
Yeah, I hate it.
I know.
I hate it. No, I really am a minimalist and I think that is the result of growing up with like exactly that kind of mentality. Particularly, it's and also being one of four kids and so the house is always kind of chaotic and so you really kind of like – you know,
want to have clean surfaces with just a few things. And I completely understandably for our parents too, right?
Yeah.
For the way that they grew up, it makes so much sense. Like, I don't think they were alone in the way that their house worked.
No.
But for us, it's meant that we've tried to seek the flip side of that.
Yeah.
What's your relationship like with space and objects? Not just clothes, but everything in your life.
So I really need a lot of light. Like, that's something that's really key to my mental health. So it's kind of funny to have written this book called Sundress.
But I don't think it's that funny at all. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. So that's like number one. So I'm the kind of person, I sleep with the curtains open because I like to wake up when the sun comes up, and I drive some people crazy. And then also there's this quote, I think it's Wendell Berry, but I might be wrong. That's have nothing in your life that you don't know to be useful and beautiful. It might be useful or beautiful, but to me it's got to be both. So I don't want it in my house. I don't want to own it if I don't get some satisfaction from how aesthetically pleasing it is, basically, and also how functional it is. And that's something that goes hand in hand with really beautiful clothes, because something might look beautiful, but if it's uncomfortable, or if you can't walk in it, or if you can't wear a bra with it, then it's no good. And that's something that I come up against a little bit with some of the fashion that's around at the moment. And I was in Sydney for Fashion Week back in May, and it really annoyed me how many runways there were where not only could you not wear a bra, you couldn't even wear underwear. Mm. And I'm just looking at these clothes and thinking about all of the women that I've ever met, and I've worked in retail for a really long time, and how they wanted to feel in clothes. And like, no one was ever like, oh great, I can't wear a bra, you know? Like, and then sometimes the designers would come out at the end after having shown these collections of like basically air with like tiny Georgette straps, and they'd be in head to toe heavy tailoring. And I just think, like, who are you designing for? Like this, like this isn't, anyway, that's a by the by.
No, I find that really interesting. Mm. What do you think women need from clothing designers in their to purchase clothes that will walk with them through their life?
Pockets.
Yes.
As many pockets as you can put in. But yeah, pockets. I think also, yeah, so you need to be able to wear a bra. You need the fabric to be natural fibers, especially in the lining of any jackets. Never buy a wool coat or a winter coat that isn't lined. You would never ever get away with selling something like that in Europe or even America, but here designers put out these jackets that aren't lined, and that's for a few reasons. A, it keeps you warmer, obviously, but also the seams and the internal construction of heavy fabrics will be very rough against your skin, and also are more likely to get damaged when you're pulling it on and taking it off and doing all these kinds of things. So a good lining will protect the coat and you as well. And then I also really believe, I think it's really important to feel beautiful. So, you know, I don't ever want to pull on a dress and that isn't cut well, you know, that doesn't suit my body shape, that doesn't make me feel, I don't know, I guess attractive. But it's more than that, because if it's cutting in at the wrong place, or if it's exposed at the wrong place, or if I can't walk in it, all of those things don't make me feel like I'm ready to take on the day.
Yeah.
And so every woman's body shape is also extremely different, and we're kind of railroaded into thinking that there's only one body type, but learning what styles work for you. And when I say work for you, I mean that you feel good in, and that you think you look good in, but you can also run around in. That's really key.
And that movement and fluidity. Yeah. That's something key that I find very difficult, because my weight has fluctuated a lot through my life. And I think I share that with a lot of women, particularly after they have children as well.
Yeah.
And so I love the idea of buying really good quality things and holding on to them. The problem is that my body changes a lot.
Mm.
Do you have a solution to that, or a strategy when you're purchasing clothes thinking my body's going to be different?
So I like buying everything as big as possible.
You do. And for a while it's black. It's really big that you're wearing a dress that isn't black to your event.
So, and that's for me, look, but also that works for my build, because I'm tall and like I've got boobs, but I don't have a waist. So it works for me to wear things that are bigger and then, and you know, but on some a different body shape, like on somebody who's shorter and who's hippie, that's not going to work. So the advantage, the reason why I do that in my head is because I'm always comfortable and I like the way things look when they're oversized, but also it's much easier for a tailor to make something smaller than it is for them to make something bigger. So that's one thing. Having a good relationship with a clever tailor who might be able to take something in or let something out for you is another way you could deal with it. But then also I think it's okay to have rotating wardrobes, you know, and to have, you know, things that you wear when your body is in one way and then also go back to the other things when your body is another way, because this is something that is across the board for women as we age, as we have children, as we, you know, go through a pandemic.
Yeah, correct.
You know, that make our bodies change. And I know I speak to designers who are, as more and more, as women become more empowered and we're thinking more and more about what that looks like commercially, who are very clever and they will work with their customers to make sure the pants can be let out or make sure the pants can be taken in. And I think that as we move away from, you know, this kind of idea that all women need to be an 8 to 12 in sizing and these very clever young female designers, and of course there are some male designers who think this way too, can be more adaptive to body types, we'll see the system changing. And that's really exciting.
It's really exciting to think that women are becoming more empowered in that way, because we're designing then for ourselves as opposed to traditionally men designing for us and then we're ending up with their... Which kind of makes sense in a way, doesn't it? If you're a guy, you're designing for what you think might be aesthetically pleasing, which is like a half-naked woman.
And just like you can't factor in, you know, and we don't want to be too gendered, obviously.
No, exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, you can't factor in how a bust works if you haven't had,
had a bust,
you know.
Yeah.
And men's bodies, you know, they have naturally less body fat than women and like – you know, it's like a different calculation. But I obviously have, I know some, you know, there are some fabulous men designing for women, but I would like to see more women designing for women.
More women doing things in general, I think. Mm. I wanted to share a lovely story because obviously we're sisters, my little sister, and there's a mythology in our family about when you were born. And I sometimes do think that people's births really reflect them as a person.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us that story of you, of what happened at your birth? Because I find it so funny.
Well, the story goes, it was a Saturday night and I can't remember if I was early or whatever, but, you know, Mum went into labour and then called the obstetrician and he was at a dinner party. So he arrived to deliver me in a tuxedo.
Yeah. Which is just the most perfect origin story, isn't it, for someone who then goes on to like have a love affair with your clothes. And the other lovely story I remember is as a three-year-old you threw a dinner party, which is very you because you've been throwing dinner parties since then. Yeah. And you wore this gorgeous pink – I don't know if it was satin, but I feel like it was –
I think it was. I think Mum got it. Our Mum was good at sewing and she used to sew our ballet costumes and everything.
Yeah.
I think Mum actually took it in, like made it appropriate for a three-year-old to wear.
Yeah, because it was a full length, satin, pink gown with like some kind of little frill around the around the like waistline, and you had pink rosettes or something in your hair. Yeah. And I was wearing a waitress outfit, which that's very typical of my relationship. But it was, and it was just like gorgeous, and you had all these little three-year-olds come over for a dinner party. I just think.
I mean, it does sound like Mum and Dad had a good time with it.
Yeah. That's the other point about it. It's not a three-year-old can like organize all of that.
Yeah.
But it's clearly something that you've held on to and is a part of your personhood, you know, from when you were very small.
Yeah. It's a funny thing the way that careers go as well, because it's not, I didn't ever really want to work in fashion. When I left school, I studied other things, but it was something that kept drawing me back in. And then at some point in the last kind of 5 years, I was like, this is just what I do.
Yeah.
This is what I'm supposed to be doing. So, and that's kind of nice when you like surrender to the plans that the world has for you.
Yeah. It's interesting that you were fighting that in a way. Well, not fighting it, but just you did professional communications and, you know, you studied politics.
Yeah.
And then you were doing law as well. You've done a law degree. Mm. And all of that is writing, I guess, in different forms. But through that whole process, you were working in fashion the whole time. And I know, being your sister and not being that great with clothes, it's always been a joy and also a real like, oh, there she goes again, wearing a cape and looking bloody fabulous, just stomping around everywhere.
Oh,
just
wearing a cape.
You did, but you made it work. Like, that's the thing with you. You just have this knack for putting clothes on and making them just come alive, which
that's so nice of you to say.
But it's so true.
It doesn't always feel that way.
Well, it looks that way from the outside, which is part of life, isn't it? So I guess I wanted to ask you now, what did it feel like to write a book?
I wrote this book during lockdown, so I really loved it. Like, there were moments that were hard and like moments where you were like, oh God, what? Why did I think I could do this? But the actual work itself, like, I was really lucky to be speaking to really smart people about solutions to the climate crisis. And that always, I would always walk away feeling so grateful that there are such clever people in the world figuring out how to solve these problems. But also I was really lucky because the content, you know, you're learning about the way plants grow and how ecosystems operate and all of that, in talking to people who've literally watched their landscapes come back to life and whose lives have changed because they've stopped farming industrially. And all of those messages of hope were just so nice to be immersed in. Mm. Anytime I had to write, like, the viscose chapter, which was about deforestation, and the last chapter, which is about textile waste, those chapters were harder because the content was much more depressing. And so in those moments, it was like, oh God. But yeah, otherwise I loved it. And I know that may be an annoying thing to hear, but also I didn't have anything else to do. So I was writing a chapter a month and, you know, that felt quite luxurious. And I also was, the last time I was working that intensely, I was studying law, and that was not fun. No. So this was a real joy to get to do. And but you know, you were on the phone to me in moments when I was like, what's going on?
This isn't even anything. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not like it was all roses, but no, I have very fond memories of being holed up in my tiny apartment, just, churning out this book.
Yeah. Can you tell us the story of moving from Paris to Melbourne in that very incredibly fast way that I think a lot of people experienced during COVID?
Yeah. So it was the end of March, no, end of February, the start of March 2020, and it was just, the virus had kicked off in Milan. We'd just done Fashion Week and everyone had been really scared. It was a really dud Fashion Week because, you know, the world was kind of crumbling and we knew, but we didn't really know what was going on. And every day, I'm sure you all remember, you know, I would wake up and check the headlines and it would be like, so-and-so shut their borders, flights cancelled, this, that. And the next Fashion Week wasn't till June, and our mum and brother are both doctors and they were both just like, just come home and see what happens. So I was running a showroom and consultancy and I could really be doing it from anywhere except I needed to be in Paris for Fashion Week. So I packed a suitcase and really honestly thought it was going to be over in a couple of months and I'd be back. And then, and so I booked a flight. I can't remember what night it was. I booked a flight for midday the next day, and that night Macron, because I was in Paris, Macron came on the TV and he said, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, ils sont gare, which means we are at war. Anyway,
wow.
Nous sommes gare, we are at war. And so he said it like 8 times or something, and that the borders were going to shut, the French borders were going to shut at midday the next day, and my flight was at 8 a.m. the next day.
Wow.
It was very scary. Yeah. And I was like, not sure that I was going to get on the plane, whatever. So I got this early cab to the airport, and I'd never seen the road so busy because it was still dark because, you know, it was cold and all the Parisians were trying to flee the city. And as I was in the car, my friend Seb messaged me and he was like, last copter out, good luck. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Last copter.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then I got on the plane and everything was fine. And I came back here and while I was on the plane, the Australian government brought in 2 weeks quarantine at home. And so I spent 2 weeks in my childhood bedroom at mum's house. And then it took probably, it was a few months before I realized that I really wasn't going back. And so, it was a kind of a blessing. It was a huge blessing, like a went from working in the industry to writing about it, and this work just makes me so happy. And that is something I'm really grateful for, because anyone that works in fashion will know that you just don't really have time anymore, because you're always – there are four fashion weeks a year, and so you're always like working towards the next one. Mm-hmm. And just like next collection, next lookbook, next line sheet, next season. And there was no time to like slow down. And we would talk about wanting to change the system. Everyone I spoke to, designers, stylists, models, everyone knew that what we were doing was bad for the planet, but no one had enough time to like think and subvert the big ship and the direction that it was going in. So the slowdown of lockdown, and I was also lucky that I had a very nimble business because it was new. You know, I'd only been going for 12 months. So I didn't have financial commitments. I didn't have staff. I didn't have overheads. I lost the business, but it didn't come with a huge financial loss. And so that allowed me to kind of, you know, have this time to think about things.
You did leave some clothes over there, didn't you?
I did. My whole apartment was still there. So I got some of it shipped back, but some of it's gotten lost. Some of the clothes I write about in the book have got lost.
I know. What's something that you really miss that you wish that you had?
Well, the black coat I write about at the start is lost. I don't know where it is.
Oh, that's devastating.
When I get back, at some point I'll get back and I will go to my friend Lex's house and like look in his carve and see if it's there. And there's a few other coats as well, like a coat. I don't know why I ever took it over, but I had this beautiful coat that I bought for myself for my 21st birthday that was from Scanlan, and it was in immaculate condition and it didn't even fit me anymore. So I don't know why I took it, but that's lost too.
Oh, that's really devastating.
Yeah.
I wanted to read a little section of the start of your book. Mm-hmm. Can I do that? Because this is what I love about it. For someone that maybe has not been in the fashion industry before and also thinks, well, this is a nonfiction book that's quite heavy on research about natural fibers.
Yeah.
But what's so glorious about it is the language and the love affair that you have with your clothes. And it makes you want to fall in love with your clothes too.
Good.
So can I read the start of it?
Yeah, you can.
Okay. I have a black dress that swings through the skirt down to the mid-calf. It has a slight split on one side that shows a little leg while you're walking and a little more at a run. It is sleeveless. The waist is slightly dropped and sits just above my hips. It's cut on the bias. I can wear a jacket over it when there is a nip in the air. It is the perfect length for my long coats. I wear it with brogues and boots, with sandals and heels. I love to wear it on dates. It is effortless in the best sense, by which I mean it is both comfortable and flattering. Do you still have that black dress?
No, that's in the car.
Oh, no.
I know.
I'm so sad. Oh, yeah. I love the way you write about it, though. Yeah. I know. It's sort of hopefully you can get back there.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that dress as the opening?
I really was – the opening of the book was really important to me because I always know from like the first page whether I want to read something or not. And so, and I wanted something that would capture like the dichotomy of the industry, because that dress is made of viscose, and viscose is really tricky fiber because it's from trees and it's linked to deforestation and all these other things. And so I wanted to set up that idea, this surprising connection to, you know, but also I wanted something that I had all of these memories of that I could talk about and bring people in that way that, because we live in our clothes, and I know that I work in the industry, so maybe I'm like more, I think about them more than other people. But when I look back over my life, like I can usually tell you what I was wearing when big things happened and how I felt in those things. And that dress in particular, and it's rare to find these pieces. And I think if all of our wardrobes were only made up of these pieces, we'd all be so much happier. But those pieces that you go, oh, I really don't want to go tonight. I feel a bit bloated and I don't, you know, and I'm a bit nervous, but I like, you know I've got to go, and I like, I'm going to put on that dress and like automatically, okay, I think I can do this.
I've got this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one of those pieces for me. Yeah. So, but also, you know, you don't know, starting writing was and often is the hardest part. And I was very lucky with most of the chapters that once I had the first sentence, I had a couple of pages And so that line, I have a black dress, felt like a good, like, and we're off.
Yeah, you know? We're off and racing.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah. Do you have a story that for someone who hasn't worked in fashion, they would find really surprising? Because you've worked with Burberry in London. You've been to runways and fashion weeks and glamorous parties and, you know, wearing beautiful two-piece sort of linen shirts and pants and by the sea. Is there a story from your days in fashion that people would find surprising? Or?
There's always little things, like one of the designers I worked for in Paris, they were so obsessed with the idea of creating original things that I think sometimes is missing in Australia, that they would, one of the collections that I worked with them for, all the whole inspiration, they didn't have a mood board, they had one photo of Frida Kahlo. And that was it. And she was sitting on a chair in the sun. It was a summer collection and she had her eyes closed. And it was like that was it, you know. That was that was all they needed. And they could draw the feeling of all the clothes they were making out of that single photo. But they were quite they were Italian. They were quite purists, which was really beautiful. Once after Fashion Week in London, when we'd just done one of the Burberry shows, and it was always like basically we would be in lockdown at Burberry HQ for like 4 days before, and then it was like all these early starts and these really big days, and you know, we'd had a I don't know if we'd gone to a party, but we'd had a late night. I thought I had the next day off, and my boss called me from the other side of London at like 8 a.m. and asked if I would bring her a bacon sandwich. I didn't go. I said, I can order you one. I said, I'm like in Stoke Newington, so it'll be. I'll be like an hour and a bit.
That is such a Devil Wears Prada vibe. Yeah. Completely. Is that what it's actually like? Like, do you think Devil Wears Prada is a good insight into the industry or not really at all?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, parts of it. And I think parts of movies like that, like they're self-fulfilling prophecies in a way. And it's not all like that, absolutely not. But there's definitely been moments in my career that have been like that. And I've heard stories about the Anna Wintour and, you know, how it is like that for her too. But and also there's part of that is just what's happening, the nucleus of a brand, what's happening when there's one person that's designing everything and they're this, you know, creative genius or, you know, super creative person, and a lot is riding on the way they're operating, and they may not necessarily be the best business person or the best manager, but they are creating an environment, and it kind of has to be this way, although it would be nice if we could balance it out a little bit, but they're creating an environment where everybody believes that what they're doing is important, and you're buying into that narrative that this little world that you're operating in with the next season and the sales and the press, you know, is changing things. And there's something really exciting about that, even if it's a little bit cultish, and it can be a little bit, can be very toxic, and fashion is famous for exploiting, you know, the wages aren't there, there's no union, there's no HR team, and you know, it can be a bit problematic, but kind of have to understand all of the things that are feeding into that perspective. And then I would also say that it's changing, where like the generation that's coming up, when I come up against bitchiness in the industry now, it feels very passé, and it's very, to me, it's not chic to be like that. It's not chic to be a drama queen. It's not chic to be snooty.
Because that is the feeling that I think sometimes comes across. It's elitist. Mm-hmm. Like there's a club and you're either in it or you're not.
Yes. Yeah. And it does, it thrives on that because it's thriving on being cool and desirable. But I also think that's changing too. So you watch the really talented young designers that are coming through, and they're inclusive, and they're making extended size ranges, and they're not cutting for just one body type. And
gender too? Mm. Are they kind of catering for almost an androgynous look or a variety of genders?
Yeah. And I think also if you're sitting outside the industry and you feel like you want to be a part of it, and there's a group of people who are not being, not including you. And I still feel that sometimes. I still feel like I'm not at the cool kids table, or, you know, like that also, it's good to just remember where those feelings are coming from their side, you know, mm-hmm. and like, you know, try to practice as much radical compassion as possible. And just, you've got to go to the people, got to go where the energy feels good for you. Yeah, and I hope that is changing, because we're not. There's no changing this industry if we just try to make it for only the coolest kids, you know?
Totally, 1,000%.
Yeah.
Here's a question. You're a very opinionated, intelligent, outspoken person in a lot of ways. I know you're introverted too, but through your life you have been that kind of woman.
Mm.
Have you always found it easy to be that kind of woman in our culture?
I guess yes and no. Like, I think part of that is innate, and I am lucky in a way that we were brought up in an environment where opinions were encouraged and being outspoken was encouraged, and it was good to have an independent thought, and it was good to kind of challenge and go against the grain. So yeah, so in a way it has come innately. Is it easy to operate in a world, in the world like that? I don't know, because on one side, I think it has brought me into, it's given me wonderful opportunities and brought me into rooms with really exciting and wonderful people. And that's also given me the courage to write a book, when you kind of would sometimes, especially just before it was released, I was like, who let me do this? I could do this. But yeah, I guess also, I think when I was in more traditional environments like law school, I found it harder, but fashion's like a female industry, even though the gender disparity at the top is disgustingly dominated by men, even though like 90% of fashion graduates are women. But look at all the creative directors of the luxury houses. It's like the skew is really actually still kind of abhorrent, and I don't know how fashion hasn't had a reckoning about that. And what I mean is, even though most of the fashion graduates are women, I think it's like 60% of the creative directors of luxury brands are men.
Wow.
And the language that's used to talk about female designers is very different to male designers. Like, men get to be masters and creative geniuses, and women are like, oh, she's designing for her own body, you know, like it's very.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Designing, a woman designing is a woman designing for women. A man designing is a man designing for everyone.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really annoying. But yeah, so I guess I think that I've been sheltered from what would have felt worse. And it might change now as well, because, you know, I've operated pretty much in like these little circles and things. But the one thing that I do where it is hard is the financial remuneration in fashion is so woeful, even though two of the richest men in the world own fashion businesses. So it's not that there's no money in these industries. It's just that because most of the workers are women, that their wages are not, you know, equivalent.
Reflective.
To, yeah. And so, like, say you, if you graduated with a master's in commerce or law, you would go into a graduate role where you would be on a salary that was a good salary. You graduate with a master's in fashion, and I don't have a master's in fashion, so I shouldn't maybe complain about this, but I have friends who graduate with masters in fashion from the top schools in the world, and they are expected to work for free.
That's for crazy.
At least 2 years, and then they might be given a junior role on basically minimum wage. And you kind of, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's infuriating because we all wear clothes.
Yeah. We all
know?
Yeah.
They're vital.
It's this like huge industry. It's also, it's not like there's no money in it. You know, it's just that part of the way they make money is by, it's exploitation.
Completely.
Yeah.
What are you grateful for? I know you touched on our upbringing. What are you grateful for our mum? I should love this question.
Our mum?
Yeah, what are you grateful for?
Well, she was a really great role model as a feminist. I think she's a really interesting feminist because she's very traditional in a lot of ways, but also she's a doctor, you know, and she's been a doctor since she was 20, and she was the primary breadwinner in the family. And this kind of quiet feminism, where it's not like overt and outspoken, but it is this like inner strength where she was, that she could wield to have things be the way that she wanted them to be. She also has extremely high standards of us, which I think is a really good a good, really good thing. And so both our parents loved us and encouraged us and supported us. She still offered now, even now, to proofread my book for and to correct the spelling and grammar.
Even after it's published.
Yeah. And I said no, because there's enough editors. But also, you know, I have memories of being practicing timetables and spelling and things with her. And those, I mean, it sounds corny, doesn't it? It sounds like we were such nerds. And we were. But
we were.
But those things are they're a huge advantage, and it's such a joy to be given the skill to read and to be encouraged to read. And all of us read so much as kids, and I think that we're all really good writers as a result. And so we've got two brothers, and yeah, so that's all. They're all really special things, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's interesting because it was a very quiet, exacting standard. Mm. I can't even, because some of my friends have come from, say, migrant families where the standard was overt. You must get the best grades. You must get into law or medicine or something. That was never said to us. I don't remember ever hearing those phrases exactly.
No. And if anything, the law and the medicine wasn't even really encouraged. It was more like you would come home with a B+ and it would be like, well, what happened?
Yeah. Or even an A. You would come home with an A and they would be like, that's an interesting choice that you've made there. You know, what happened? I should so big to your teacher. You know, just this very quiet, high standard. And even now I'm nervous to show mum things I've made because of that reason, because she has such high standards, which I guess you rise to.
I think so. And it wasn't like we have high standards of you and we're over here not helping you reach them. Like, you know, there was, especially academically, lots of time and support, and you know, if we wanted help on a project, we would get all the help in the world. And
if we had an interest we wanted to pursue, they were immediately there.
They were buying the violin or the flute or the trombone or the drum kit, or you know,
correct,
yeah, and driving us to whatever sport it was. And
correct,
yeah,
I think as well they both had very high standards of themselves and were very, in a way, harsh inner critics of themselves, which we've also inherited, I think.
And that's not so great.
No, that's
that a therapy thing.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot.
Give yourself a break.
Yeah, just be a little compassionate. Every therapist I've ever seen has said that to me. The first thing they're like, yeah, exactly, correct. And look, there's duality, you know, good and bad in that. Mm. Let's talk about dad now, because you've dedicated the book to dad.
Yes.
For my dad.
Claire's put a box of tissues very subtly on the table.
I know. Why have you dedicated it to dad?
Dad was, well, he was also an academic and a writer. When I say I'm not an academic, he was a writer. And he was a real force in all of our lives. And he was very encouraging of kind of these kind of pursuits. And he was writing about the environment when he died. He was in the middle of writing a series of 7 books. And it felt very, like, very bittersweet to know that that was the last thing he was working on and to be kind of tackling these similar themes. And also, while I was writing it, I was living in Fitzroy, and that was very close to where he started his career as a bioethicist. And I felt, and it sounds really a bit, I don't know, I felt his presence around me a lot while I was writing it, and that felt really special. And I think that, it's anyone who's lost a parent or lost anyone that they love will, I think, and you know what that feels like, to be achieving something that you wish you could share with them, or going through anything in life that you wish you could share with them. And yeah, it felt important to me to dedicate the book to him and honor him in that way.
What do you think the best lessons he gave you were?
So I used to play a lot of netball, and I was a goal attack. And he would always, when he came to my games, when I was shooting, and I wasn't really tall enough to be a goal attack at the level I was playing at. But when I was younger, I was a very accurate goaler, and that was why I was good. And he would always yell out steady when I was shooting, and it became like a running joke because he had this big, loud, deep voice and, you know, he would yell steady. And that is something that I think of because I have a habit of rushing things or being impulsive, and that's something that comes up for me now as an adult when I'm you know, trying to like be a bit level-headed. And those impulsive and rushing things are inherited traits from him as well. So I think that, but also as he got older in his career, he was quite headstrong when he was younger, and he mellowed out as he got older and became much kind of kinder and more compassionate. And I think really watching him, I think there's a really big lesson in, you know, trying to exercise that kind of kindness. And the real strength of intellect that he had was trying to be empathetic and understand what people were going through. And I really do feel that that is a great sign of intelligence, to not be trying to wield it over people, but to try to bring people along with you. How good I am at doing that, I don't know. But it's also that kind of humility is always a much easier place to try to operate from too, I think.
Completely. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think he would think of the book?
I don't know. No, well, he was so proud of all of us, so I think he would be very proud. I don't know. I think he'd just be proud of it. It would be hard to disappoint him.
Yeah, it would be, though.
Writing a first book, I think.
It would be. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
With this kind of topic anyway,
I think. And look, I think Dad was the kind of person that would talk about his kids to anyone for whatever we were doing. Mm. Claire's playing the flute. She's done her grade 3 exam. You know, he would just, wherever you were in the world, he would want to talk about you and your achievements, and he was just so proud of us in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Do you find it difficult that he also politically had different beliefs to you?
I think definitely there were years when I found it really challenging, but not so much now. I think that he was such a balanced thinker in so many ways, and the aspects of the church that I will always disagree with him on, I think he struggled with them as well. I feel regret and that there's not more time to talk about some of those more contentious issues that we don't share, because I feel like that some of my understanding of his attitudes is not as in-depth as I would like it to be. No, I also think that he would probably have kept evolving along with us. So, you know, it's just part of life that you don't always share the same beliefs as people around you. And I think something for Mum and Dad that is very true of their faith is that, and what they passed on to us is this idea of kind of forgiveness and compassion and working to help other people and operate with kindness and all of those values. I agree on some of the other things that we don't agree on, you know, okay, whatever, everybody has
differences of opinion. Yeah. And I think that's the really interesting crux, right, of why people have asked me before, why are you the way you are, or why are you able to see different points of view? And I think it's because of their encouragement that every thought you have is rigorously debated in your own self.
Yeah.
And so you have to justify why you think that way. But because other people think differently, it doesn't mean there's something inherently wrong with them.
No.
It's about the thought and the thinking and that deep philosophy about humanity and our place here, and that is actually a real gift, and in a way I'm incredibly grateful for that upbringing, because I think it really does, as you said, give you a depth of compassion for people from all different sides, and it's quite incredible really to think that Dad was able to do that, to leave the door open for us all to be who we are in different ways with the kind of, in some ways, quite rigid thinking he had about particular issues. And I totally agree with you. That's one of the deep sadnesses I have, that he's not here for me to debate with him as an adult.
Yeah. And just to ask more questions, you know. And that is like, you know, the cruelest thing about death. It's not having more time. And like also, that regret of looking back and being like, why wasn't I paying more attention? Why didn't I see that life is so precious and fragile? And that's also a gift of grief as well.
Yeah.
On the other side of it.
It is absolutely makes you more grateful for the moments that you do have.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You talk about natural fibers in the book. I want to talk back on that before we finish.
Yeah.
And there's some beautiful stories around each of those. Mm. I love particularly the story around silk.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the mulberry trees and that connection with a Chinese princess, really, or the daughter of an emperor?
Yeah. So there was this princess, oh gosh, I don't know how many thousands of years ago it was. I need to read my book. But she was sitting under, she was drinking a cup of tea, sitting in a under a mulberry tree, and a cocoon fell out of the tree and landed in her cup of tea. And the story goes that she, when she went to pull the cocoon out, it became a single translucent thread, and she had discovered silk, basically. So silk is drawn from the cocoon of the Bombyx mori, which is a type of moth. And then she was so fascinated by it, she did experiments and realized that the silk was more beautiful when the worms were eating the leaves of mulberry trees. And she taught the woman of her court how to spin and weave it. And basically she invented silk. And the Chinese guarded the secrets of silk making for centuries.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was like punishable by death if you shared them.
My goodness. Yeah.
And then eventually, I mean, all of this is kind of myth and, you know, so we don't actually know. But the story goes that someone smuggled some silkworms in their cane. I think it was a monk, and took them to the a Roman emperor, and then the secrets of silk making were out. But that's why we have the Silk Road, because like they would traverse these kind of the trade of it, like it had to be, the silk had to be carried along this really treacherous terrain from China, you know, all the way through to the Mediterranean. So it's really a special fiber, and it kills me because all these like companies are investing money in how to replicate the properties of silk, and they're like using like, you know, genetics and DNA and like all these different things to like manufacture synthetic, but well, they're not synthetic, but they're, you know, different versions of silk. But it's just like
miraculous.
It's miraculous. I know, and we already have it. And it's like, it really, a single filament is supposed to be stronger than a single filament of steel. It's a protein fiber, so it's warm, but you know, like put on a silk dress and then we
can then we have a discussion.
Yeah.
Because that's so beautiful. And I love that you're wearing silk to your book launch tonight.
Yeah.
Yay. I am wearing silk. It's so exciting.
It is.
Yeah. How do they make silk now? Like, as in not the synthetic things that they're doing, but is it predominantly made in China now?
Yeah. So most of the world's silk, it's like I think 90% comes from China and India, but China's like by far the most dominant. So the way that the silk we talk about in the book, so you have industrial silk farms, so it's like that are operated with not necessarily chemicals, but like lots of machinery and lots of energy, because you need to keep the silkworms at a certain temperature so that they kind of thrive. But the type of silk that we talk about in the book is made by a company called Bombyx, and they're in Nanchong in China, which is where the Empress discovered the silkworm in her tea. And they regeneratively grow the mulberry trees. So they have small fields of mulberry trees, and they've got like animals running through them, and the trees are on tiers so they can grow them in ways that restore the carbon to the soil. They're not using any chemicals or fertilizers or pesticides. And what that means is effectively the silk that they're manufacturing, because it's all made with renewable energy, is carbon negative. But so the way it works, you grow the mulberry trees because you need a lot of mulberry tree leaves to feed the silkworms. And then you have huts on the borders of the groves. So the farmers are harvesting the leaves and then feeding them to the silkworms. And the silkworms have been bred over thousands of years, so they're blind and they can't fly and they need human assistance to mate.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So anyway, so look, you feed them the mulberry leaves and then they grow and grow and grow, and then they spin their cocoons, and then you boil the cocoons. And the boiled worms are either fed to animals or actually eaten by the communities that make the silk, or they're put back on the land as fertilizer. And then you take the silk cocoons and they're taken to a factory and they're degummed and cleaned because there's silkworm saliva that binds the cocoons together.
So interesting.
Yeah. And then they, yeah, so you pull on a reel, they're unspooled and someone's got to watch and make sure there's no flaws in the silk, and then you weave the silk together, and then there are different chemical treatments you can do if you want to, or you can just leave it natural or dye it or whatever, and that's how you do it. So there are people who are like, oh, no, that's like not good to kill the silkworms. And there is a kind of silk called pea silk that's mainly made in India where they let the silkworm come out, but it breaks the strands and so the silk isn't as smooth. And what I feel about that is, like, look, I'm not a vegan. I eat meat. So I don't, when these communities are using the silkworms as subsistence for food, I don't really think we can differentiate it from wearing leather. And also, you know, in the hierarchy of the way the world operates, this is part of the natural cycles of life, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're making fake silk, what you're doing is, you know, replicating genetics, which takes a lot of energy, and then you're usually feeding that stock with something like sugarcane, or which has been grown on in a monocrop that's probably been responsible for some deforestation, that's probably actually killed a lot more animals and like is more toxic for the environment. So I think when you do like a full life cycle assessment, the fact that we boil the silkworms is very low down on the
priority list.
Yeah.
Gosh,
yeah.
That's so fascinating. Your book's full of stories like that about how flax is created as well and how hemp is such an incredible fabric as well.
Yeah.
Why is hemp particularly interesting?
So hemp is a fascinating one because it was outlawed basically until 2018. So, and that it became outlawed with the rise of synthetics in like around the 1950s. And that was because it's like the sister plant of marijuana, but also, and so it basically it was made illegal, but it doesn't have the psychoactive properties of marijuana. It's like this, the chemical component is called THC. And in hemp, it's like 0.3, whereas in marijuana, it's 20%. So it's a big difference. Anyway, so where they've just realized that we should all be growing more hemp. And the reason why they've realized that is because it's this really amazing plant. It grows, it can absorb twice as much CO2 as a forest while it's growing, which is insane.
That's insane.
Yeah. And so it can be used for seed, which is a superfood, for oil, which is also a superfood, for fiber, and which makes a type of fabric that's very similar to linen in the way it looks and feels. But also it can be used for biofuel, and they've found ways to make bioplastics out of it too. Like it's this very, very special plant, and it grows really fast, and it grows up to like 10 feet tall. So it's really, really big, and it depends, like all crops. And so it depends where you grow it, but it usually grows just with rainwater and it doesn't really need pesticides. But also what's most amazing about it is that it's been found to clean the soil. So if you've got like toxic things in the soil because you've had a chemical plant nearby, or, you know, something bad has happened, if you grow hemp on those fields, the hemp's roots are so long and deep and strong that they can suck up all of that toxicity essentially and leave you with a clean field, which is, it's pretty phenomenal.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is interesting. Yeah. And why is it that we're not using hemp everywhere? I know you said it was illegal.
It was illegal. That's the main reason.
Is that the main reason?
Yeah, so it was made, it was outlawed in America, and the reason why, it was around the time of Prohibition when they outlawed it, and like it's not entirely clear why. It might be as simple as it was a misunderstanding by the lawmakers of the difference between hemp
and marijuana.
But there is some implications that by some of the people that I've spoken to, that it was financial, because it was the end of Prohibition, so they weren't able to make money from alcohol, the banning of alcohol anymore. So they added in hemp. And so that meant that they could
replace it with that.
You know, yeah. And also, who knows? So it was outlawed by America, and then it became outlawed all over the world, and even in China, who are now the biggest producers of hemp. So
they make their uniforms out of hemp, don't they?
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah. So in Australia, I actually don't We are growing it here, but I think probably that it will require too much irrigated water because we don't have enough rainfall for it to actually be so good for the environment. But definitely in America, there's a renaissance happening where they're trying to bring it back. But it's complicated again because to be worth your while to grow hemp for clothing, you need to have manufacturing close by that can actually take the hemp plant all the way through to fabric. And all the manufacturing pretty much has moved to China. So that's the other complicating thing. But there's researchers in the UK and Cambridge, and there is this movement towards it.
Yeah. And can you tell us about flax? Because flax becomes linen, right? And yes. I didn't know that until I read your book. I feel like I should have known that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So flax is amazing. It's grown, 80% of the world flax is grown between Belgium and France along the edge of the North Sea. So that's like right up near Normandy where it's like really cold. And they've been growing it there for hundreds of years. And so all of the processing happens quite close by. But in that location, in other parts of the world, it will need to be irrigated. But in that location, it really grows just with the winds coming off the North Sea. If anybody's ever been to Normandy, you'll remember how cold and windy those beaches are. And it grows with very minimal, even when you're doing it in a traditional way, minimal fertilizers and pesticides. Those farmers, because it's such a low impact crop, they've got less incentive to move towards regenerative practices because it's like they're almost there anyway. Mm. But there is a growing movement towards organic linen. And so what it grows like this tall woody stalk, and then it flowers, and so it turns like the fields this really beautiful blue. And then when they harvest it, they basically pull it out of the ground and then lay it down flat, and then it lays on the fields for a couple of weeks, and it begins this process called redding, which is basically the softening of the outer woody stalks to get to the inside, which is what gets woven into linen. And so then once it's like changed colors on the fields, they harvest it all up and they take it to the factories, and then they do this thing called scooching where they break the woody stalks down further and eventually pull out the strands, and then they process them into linen fibres.
And that's why it's called French linen? Is that why?
Yeah, that's because why. If it's from France.
If it's from France.
Linen. Yeah.
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 Oh, it's so exciting. For people listening, it's so worth getting Lisa's book and reading more about this. And we won't go into all of the fibres that you talk about. You'll have to read the book. But it's beautiful, and the interwoven with the stories of your clothes and the stories of your life working in fashion is just glorious. So congratulations.
Thank you.
What's next? Where do you see yourself going next?
Yeah, that's a good question. a part of the work that I do is working with brands to help them source more fibers and that are farmed this way, and also working with companies to help tell their stories about the work that they're doing. So, you know, really we're just at the beginning of regenerative agriculture and the journey. And the change that's happening in the fashion industry. I really want to go and visit some more farms and spend some more time on the landscapes and, you know, learning more about how we make all of this happen. And also I write a column in The Guardian about how to care for your clothes. It comes out every Tuesday, and that's the other part of this work that's really important to me. When we're talking about how we change the industry, we have to change our relationship with clothes as well and make them last longer so we reduce our consumption and lots of things.
Yeah, lots of things. And that column's called Closet Clinic.
Yes.
Right? Exactly. Yes. And you also write for the Saturday Paper.
I do. Yeah. Yes, I do. So I'm this fashion editor for the Saturday Paper and focus on reviewing collections for them. But I also occasionally will write a story about farming, cotton or wool.
Because that's really your passion, isn't it, the regenerative farming?
Yeah.
Because it's such a beautiful story to be telling and incredibly vital and important.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you for coming on Tons. It's been such a joy.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Yeah. And people can find you on Instagram as well.
Yes, at Lucianne Tonti.
Lucy, that's probably the best place to go, do you think?
Yes.
To start finding all of your things.
Yes, please.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, I can't wait to go to the book launch tonight. We'll have to share a photo of you in your beautiful suit. Dress made by silkworms.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's time to celebrate you, I think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Claire.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay.
You've been listening to a podcast with me, Claire Tonti, and this week with Lucy Ann Tonti. I'm so thrilled that you listened through to this episode. And if you would like to purchase Sundressed, it is available in lots of good bookstores all across Australia and online at Booktopia. There's a link in the show notes. For more from Lucy Ann, you can head to Closet Clinic at The Guardian or her writing at The Saturday Paper or follow her on Instagram at Lucy Ann Tonti. And for more from me, you can head to my website, clairetonti.com, or you can also find me at my other podcast, Suggestible, which I do with my husband man, James Clement, aka Mr. Sunday Movies. That comes out every Thursday where we recommend you things to watch, read, and listen to and make fun of each other along the way. All right, I'm off to get ready for her book launch tonight. How exciting. I have to figure out what to wear. Oh, I'm not as glamorous as this fashion crowd. So we shall see. Wish me luck. Thank you as always to Raw Collings for editing this week's episode. This is the final episode in season 2 of Tonts. I'm so grateful to everyone that has listened and been a part of this season. I've so appreciated you. So if you have recommendations for guests or topics or just comments, you can email them to tontspod@gmail.com or come along to Instagram and comment on the episodes. I usually share an audiogram made by the wonderful Maisie over there. Awesome video footage from the episode. So that's a lovely spot to have a chat to about the topics and conversations that we're having here. And while I'm on break in August, we'll be sharing some old episodes from my other podcast, Just Make the Thing, that I made 5 years ago. The audio quality isn't quite as good, but there are just some beautiful gems and I wanted to share them with you if you haven't heard them before. Interviews with the comedian Geraldine Hickey, where she talks about growing up Catholic and queer and how her perception of herself and her life completely changed. An interview with the radio host Bonte Diamond, and that's a gorgeous chat about motherhood, about hustling your way into a career that you love, about focus and lots of other things besides. And I did that in her house. It was just so much fun. Another episode I wanted to share with you is one about failure. Now, this is one of the earliest episodes that I made. It's episode 6, and it's really all about exactly what the title suggests, the one about failure. I deleted my episode and I recorded it late one night with James when I was in tears and not sure if I'd ever make anything again. So that's a little episode for people who, like me, and I'm a little bit better now along the journey, struggle with their creativity and getting things out in the world. So you might find that episode valuable. And the last one I wanted to share with you is one of my favorites. It's a chat with the comedian Jess Perkins, who you might recognize from Triple J. And it just talks about being a woman in comedy and her life story. And it's just gorgeous. So that one is over there as well. All right. That's it from me. I'm going to see you in September. Right back on the first Friday in September will be the new season of Tonts. So can't wait to start that season. I've got some really great guests coming up. Author Sally Hepworth, naturopath Freya Lawler, and a whole lot of others besides. So looking forward to that. Oh, Astrid Edwards, who is an incredible writer and teacher as well, and podcaster. So can't wait to share those with you, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweater starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.